Welcome back to another edition of Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Coming up in today's show, we'll hear from features editor Jim Higgins. Jim recently talked to a Brookfield High School graduate and Pulitzer Prize winner, whose work is returning to Milwaukee. We'll also catch up with our editorial editors about their coverage of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's death. First, new evidence could lead to a revelation in the 40-year-old cold case murder of John Zara. John's death was the focus of Gina Barton's 7-part series Unsolved, which came out at the end of 2015. Barton and Michael Meidenbauer discuss new evidence, how it could affect the case, and the role of journalists in getting cold case investigations reopened.
All right, Gina, so your new development in Unsolved revolves around one piece of new evidence. What is that evidence?
The piece of new evidence is a belt.
A belt.
A brown basket-woven belt that was found in the basement of one of the suspects, Daniel Acker.
Okay, and he is he's the convicted pedophile that we kind of followed throughout the original series.
Right. He was a swim coach back in the 70s and kind of was hanging around the crime scene. And then in 2009, when the police started investigating him for child molesting, they found all kinds of creepy stuff related to John Zara's case in his basement. But what happened was the Greenfield Police Department had all of this evidence, and they didn't give it to Hales Corners until late last year. And that's when Detective Schoonover from Hales Corners found the belt, and it's a pretty small belt, and Acker's a pretty big guy.
There's a lot of kind of science-y type stuff in the article here, so could you break that down for us?
As you know, DNA is one of the best ways to get evidence to definitively solve a crime, and DNA technology keeps changing and evolving. So Acker said that he didn't know John, had never met John. And so if the state crime lab here in Wisconsin is able to find John's DNA on a belt that was in Acker's basement, it's going to be pretty hard for him to explain how it got there. And then that will solidify him as a suspect. The other thing that's going on is when I first started reporting the story, I had asked the police what they had done in terms of epithelial DNA testing or skin cell DNA testing. And they weren't too familiar with that process. And so last week, the police chief and one of the detectives took John's clothing and some of the other evidence in this case to a private lab in Ohio where they can do a more advanced type of DNA testing, maybe something the previous 4 tests have missed because of changes in technology, greater expertise at this private lab. So they're taking one last crack at his clothing.
Do they have an idea of the timeline for this?
So the evidence that's being tested by the state crime lab is going to take a while because they have a backlog and they're also doing some other testing of things that were in John's locker, stuff like that. So I don't really have a time frame on that. In the private lab, it takes 4 weeks to actually try and develop a profile from the evidence. But then after that, it can take several weeks or months more to compare that with different suspects or if there's a good enough profile with the FBI database.
And you say this new evidence kind of came to light after the Unsolved series, which ran late last year. Can you kind of talk about how your role as a reporter has affected this case?
Right. Well, this was pretty cool in a couple of ways. Basically, when I asked them about the DNA testing, they weren't very familiar with it and hadn't really thought to do it. So that was one of the conversations that I had with the police. Another conversation was that they didn't necessarily feel like it was going to be solved without some kind of publicity, cooperation from the public interest in it. So that's why they were so forthcoming with me in terms of sharing all the police reports and things like that. So that was definitely another way that this whole thing evolved. And then it was after the series ran that Greenfield decided, yeah, we should just give all of our evidence to Hales Corners. And that is when Detective Schoonover from Hale's Corners found this belt.
And this is a belt that is alluded to in a journal entry of Acker's from a really long time ago?
Well,
it could be construed to be alluded to.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is they're not sure if it's the belt, if it's John's belt. Acker, though, seems to have known that John's belt was missing or that John didn't have a belt. There was no belt found among his clothing when he was found. So that was strange. And Acker wrote about that fact in his journal. But only one police report out of many, many, many police reports even talked about a belt. So did Acker make that up? How did he know that? Is it even true? And then the other thing about the belt is that the police chief in Hale's Corners seems to think that the belt is kind of too new to be John's belt. It's stamped made in China, and we didn't import nearly as many things from China back in the 70s as we do now. And he said it also had that kind of new leather smell, not the way that, you know, you would think a 40-year-old belt would be. So right. It's definitely not a sure thing, but it's okay. Something that they're looking into that's new.
It's a shot.
Right.
Okay. Just want to bring up, we kind of talked a little before about your involvement in this case kind of spurring some new action that could potentially lead to new developments. This isn't really the first time that's happened. Can you tell me about Fatal Identity?
Sure. I mean, writing crime narratives is one of my favorite things to do. And so about 10 years ago, I worked on another story about an identity theft that led to a homicide. And it's a really interesting story that the killer almost got away with it. And at the time I started reporting the story, they had a good suspect but hadn't charged anybody with this homicide of a Hale's Corners man named Tim Wicks. And after Fatal Identity was published, then the prosecutor who had jurisdiction all the way in North Dakota decided that, boy, public pressure was out there and he should just take a shot. And so he finally charged it, and Dennis Gady was found guilty.
Gina's update can be found in today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. To read Gina's series, visit jsonline.com/unsolved. You'll find her Unsolved podcast there as well. It's also available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR member station, is airing the Unsolved podcast this week. You'll hear them at 10 a.m. on 89.7 FM during Lake Effect. If you're interested in reading Gina's Fatal Identity series, it's available online at jsonline.com/fatalidentity. The Milwaukee Rep will stage the play The Invisible Hand with a run beginning Wednesday, continuing through April 3rd. The play is written by Pulitzer Prize winner Ayad Akhtar, who is a Brookfield Central High School graduate. His plays grapple with capitalism and the intersection of American and Muslim identity. Journal Sentinel book editor Jim Higgins interviewed the playwright about his work and his life growing up in Wisconsin. He talks with Ashley Lutheran about the interview and the upcoming production of The Invisible Hand.
So, Jim, when did you first hear about Ayad Akhtar and his work?
The first time I learned about Ayad Akhtar was about 2005 when my colleague Dwayne Dudek wrote about his work in a film called The War Within, in which he co-wrote and played a terrorist who was relying on some unsuspecting friends. But the big explosion of interest in his work came in 2012 and 2013 when his plays The Invisible Hand and Disgraced started to get a lot of attention, and he published an autobiographical novel, American Dervish, that reflects on his experiences growing up in the Brookfield area.
And how does his personal background influence his work?
Well, he said many times in interviews he grew up in a secular Muslim family. His parents emigrated here from Pakistan. They're both physicians. His father was a pioneer in bringing cardiology, electrophysiology to Wisconsin. So he grew up in Brookfield, one of the very few non-white people in his whole environment. But he So he had his own personal exploration of what it meant to be Muslim and how invested he would be or would not be in his religion. And also being a non-white person at that time in the 70s and early 80s in Wisconsin. But he said here he experienced very little prejudice. He just sort of, people didn't really care too much about, you know, where he came from. And so he found it a kind, warm place. But his work really grapples with questions about being an American and being of Muslim background and what do those things mean together. I find it fascinating because, one, that's a very specific set of highly charged questions today. But two, that's also a common theme in American literature and drama. It's the same kind of thing that first-generation Jewish American writers went through in the 40s and 50s.
This whole question of identity and what it means to be an American and also be true to your family.
Exactly. And where your allegiance goes. And also, there in every one of his plays, there are questions of self-acceptance. Do you accept yourself? You know, do you embrace all parts of yourself?
What were your impressions meeting him?
He's a very smart guy who speaks very well. And it's an uncommon experience for me to sit down to interview someone who's so much smarter than I am. I worry about if I'm going to make it through there okay. But he's a very bright, very intelligent guy. He'll talk about enlightenment and economic theory and at the same time say that he learned as much about writing from Seinfeld as anything else. And he does this without pretension and in a very natural way.
So what should audiences expect when they go to see his play, The Invisible Hand?
Right, The Invisible Hand, which the Milwaukee Rep is performing, is a very smart and also tense drama about an American banker who's kidnapped and being held by three Muslim guys in Pakistan. They're holding him for ransom. That's not an uncommon situation, but the American banker, Nick, kind of destabilizes things by saying, you're never going to get that money from me. Why don't I teach you how to make money? So it's kind of a mental war of wills between the Western view of self-interest and the interests of his three captors. It's very tense, but also a very smart play with some unusual humor in it, too.
And you mentioned it will be performed at the Rep. How did Akhtar connect with the Rep, and will we see more of his plays there?
We will. The Rep and Akhtar have a four-year arrangement where the Rep will do one of his plays each of the next four seasons, and the plan is that will culminate in a new play that he'll write for the Rep. After he won the Pulitzer Prize for drama for Disgraced, he was speaking in a big theater convention. And Mark Clements, the Rep's artistic director, was in line to get a book signed. And I saw the name tag, and he already knew who Mark was because he reads our publication. Thank you very much, Mr. Akhtar. And they hit it off in the discussion, and he's very interested in his hometown theater. He's done some things that aren't publicized to help the Rep out in fundraising and goodwill. And so he wants a strong relationship, you know, with his hometown theater.
And a question for you, what does it mean for you to be able to tell these stories for a metropolitan daily like the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel?
Well, the theater is part of our culture and what it means to be a civilized person in the democracy. And I'm excited that the Rep is taking on a contemporary playwright who does some pretty hard stuff, and we'll get to see it.
Read Jim's story in today's Journal Sentinel. It's also available at tapmilwaukee.com. Buffering, buffering, buffering. Anyone who has been dogged by slow internet speeds knows that term well. In rural parts of Wisconsin and the nation where internet speeds are slow, that's about to change. Journal Sentinel business reporter Rick Barrett dug into a new AT&T initiative coming next year. It will offer high-speed wireless connections in rural areas. These are different from the hardwire systems typically used for high-speed broadband service like UVerse. The new system uses an antenna mounted to the home to receive signals from a nearby cell tower. Rick talks with the Journal Sentinel's Jim Nelson about what's coming.
I'm Jim Nelson from the Journal Sentinel Business Section here with Rick Barrett, business reporter who's got a story in the upcoming Journal Sentinel Business Section about a rural wireless broadband type service. Rick, what's AT&T have up its sleeve for customers in rural parts of our state?
Jim. What's coming in 2017, AT&T said it will begin offering what it calls fixed wireless service in rural Wisconsin. And with the fixed wireless service, a customer will connect with a cell tower. And that is an alternative instead of having cables strung to their home. The cell tower will become their internet connection.
This is a big improvement over the other ways that people get to the internet in rural parts of the state. What do people do now?
Well, it varies a lot, but in some cases you're limited to either satellite connection or your cell phone. That's about all that's available in some places.
And how did this come about? Is this was this encouraged by the feds or by the state, or how did AT&T get the impetus to do this?
Yeah, well, where this is coming from is the FCC has what it calls the Connect America Fund, and that's putting millions and millions of dollars into bringing broadband to rural America. As part of that, AT&T says they can bring the service to rural areas better using this fixed wireless technology, and then they can, because it's so expensive to lay fiber optic cable in the ground in rural areas, it's just not affordable to do that.
And do you think we'll be seeing this kind of service offered by other companies, Verizon, U.S. Cellular?
I think we will. I think a lot of the telecoms have realized that it's just too expensive to put in fiber optic cable in rural areas and to serve the number of customers that they can get from it. So with the fixed wireless, they can reach more people and it won't cost them nearly as much.
And this is for residential users. I would imagine this would be probably not so good for a business that had high need for high-speed data.
Yeah, that's probably correct. This is aimed primarily for home use, but it could also be used for small businesses too.
Okay. And what about the speeds? I know when I try to watch in some parts of the state, when I try to watch a YouTube or something on my video on my phone, it's not very good. But when you get to a place where there's wireless or 4G LTE or whatever, it's faster. Do you think this will be sufficient speeds to watch a movie at home or to do some gaming?
It should be, because under the Connect America Fund to programming, under the Connect America Fund, the telecoms have to meet certain requirements. And one of those requirements is the service has to be at least 10 megabits per second download speed and at least 1 megabit per second upload speed. And if you think about that, I mean, you can watch a Netflix movie at about 5 megabits per second speed, and that's a high-definition movie. So it should be adequate for most home use.
So what do you suppose this is going to cost us or cost folks that live in rural areas?
That's a good question, because you're going to have to look at the amount of data that people use, and AT&T hasn't said yet whether there will be data caps per month and exactly what the cost is going to be on a monthly basis.
How did you hear about this? Did they make an announcement, or is this something that showed up in regulatory documents in some fashion?
I heard about this just through the Connect America Fund reporting that I did a little bit earlier. It was just referenced in there as one of the ways that they can reach rural areas more effectively than using cable and copper wire.
What do you suppose the size of the market is that AT&T is trying to tap? How many homes do you think they're trying to reach with this?
Well, under the Connect America Fund program, they're supposed to make this service available to 24,000 locations. And a location is, for the most part, an individual home. Could be a small business, too, but for the most part, it's residential.
And you've written a lot about wireless and the cable industry and so forth. What do you see as the next big things coming down the pike in the next couple of years in this in these industries?
I think the biggest thing is going to be the demands for more bandwidth, in that people are going to have more intensive video experiences. They're going to demand a lot more in terms of their home internet connection. And that raises a big question as to whether this particular service will be enough going forward with the demand for video and the demand for online type services. And right now, this is probably adequate, but is it enough in the future?
Find out more about what's coming from AT&T in the Journal Sentinel and on jsonline.com. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia was laid to rest yesterday. His death has created a political row over the next Supreme Court nomination. Covering Scalia's death and subsequent political fallout was a difficult task for the editorial team. Here's editors Ernie Franzen and Dave Haynes on how they accomplished that.
Hi, this is Ernie Franzen, Associate Editorial Page Editor of the Journal Sentinel. I'm here with David Haynes, the Editorial Page Editor, and we want to talk about the death of Antonin Scalia and what we did this last week to reflect and talk about that. David, he died a week ago Saturday. What was your first reaction?
Well, I was getting ready to go to Mass, and I got an alert on my iPhone, and I think this happened to many people, and I was stunned. Scalia is a giant in legal circles and on the Supreme Court, and I knew immediately that his death would become a major issue in the presidential campaign. And so it was important that as opinion leaders in our community that we try to find opinion from across the political spectrum as soon as we could to reflect what was about to happen. And so I began tweeting and retweeting, as we all do these days, what I was seeing from reputable news organizations, especially after it was confirmed. And then on Sunday morning, I had the idea of sending an email to Joseph Kearney, who's the dean of the Marquette Law School. Joe and I go back a number of years now. We've worked together on a lot of projects involving public policy. They've set up quite an interesting public policy center there at the law school, and so we've tapped into that on numerous occasions. And I knew that Joe had been a law clerk for Scalia back in the 90s and might want to write about it.
You also, on Sunday, posted a couple of pieces online but didn't go into the Monday paper with that. What was the thinking behind that?
Right. We had a piece from E.J. Dion, who is a liberal columnist for The Washington Post, and we had another piece from Noah Feldman from Bloomberg View, whose politics, to me, were a little less certain. But I was concerned, again, about this idea of balance. And so I wanted to get out there whatever we could, as quickly as we could, so people could read it online. But in the paper, there's a real sense – you need to have a real sense of balance. And I felt that it would look too tilted one way if we published those pieces on Monday without a conservative point of view, which we sought out then on Monday.
And we ran several conservative viewpoints during the week, several op-eds, I think 10 total.
We've run 10 so far.
We also – did an editorial. You wrote the editorial on Wednesday.
Correct.
Talk about some of the thinking behind the editorial, which called on Obama to do his duty and the Senate to do its duty.
Well, it's all part of, as I always like to say about our editorials, we're part of the conversation. We're not the most important part even of the conversation. And so we felt as a board that the president gets elected for 4 years, not three. And so that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader's call for essentially saying they wouldn't support any candidate coming up from Obama was just sort of absurd. The president should nominate a qualified candidate, and the Senate should do its job and vet that candidate and decide if that candidate is worth confirming.
Now, you talked about 10 pieces. Is that overkill? And why wouldn't it be overkill?
Well, it's a whole lot of content, no question about it. Again, we tried to have both conservatives and liberals commenting so that there'd be a broad discussion and our readers could make up their own minds after they read those. It's a lot. I don't think it's too much for this reason. It has become a major issue in a presidential campaign. The Supreme Court could potentially flip from 5-4 conservative to 5-4 liberal, and that could change virtually any aspect of American life based on how they rule on these decisions. So I think in this case, it's a lot of content, but probably not too much.
You can find the full collection of coverage about Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's death online at jsonline.com/opinion. Tuesday's local primary election narrowed the Milwaukee mayoral candidate pool down to incumbent Mayor Tom Barrett and Alderman Bob Donovan. Our political panel took a look at this upcoming election 2 days later during our weekly JS on Politics show.
It's another case where none of the incumbents, you know, got over 50% of the vote, which is often kind of a magic, even if it's just a psychological number at this point. But Tom Barrett came in at 46%. Bob Donovan, who will be facing, had 33%. And then Alderman Joe Davis, who dropped out and endorsed Donovan, had a smaller number. Does that endorsement?
Well, he lost.
Lost. But
yeah.
I mean, does that Davis endorsement help Donovan, or his voters a natural Donovan constituency, do you think?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of Davis supporters are not going to back Donovan. Davis has talked about the mass incarceration of African American males. He's talked about more discrepancy in Milwaukee of African Americans tending to be poorer in less developed neighborhoods. That is not Donovan's bread and butter for his campaign. He is the law and order guy. He is more cops. So he's since said, at that announcement, he said that he is willing to sit down and talk with people, which is the first time I've heard him say that, because he's typically wants chases and more beat cops. And I don't see the Davis constituents being natural Donovan supporters.
But you did see Donovan going on Black Radio yesterday, something I've never heard or seen him do before. So it's something he realizes he has to do. He finished with 33% of the vote. That's a 13 percentage point gap. There was a poll that came out just late last week that showed among African Americans that Barrett gets almost half of the vote, much more, twice what Davis gets, and Donovan's under 10%. So he would have to do major work to get out there. The only thing that would be interesting is if Sheriff Clark would get involved somehow and take a side in this thing, because his politics not much different than Donovan, and his message has resonated in the black community.
All right, let me ask you just really quickly before we move on, Dan. So of the three, who do you think is the incumbent in the safest position for April?
I would say the mayor. The mayor, because one thing we didn't discuss is the Democratic presidential contest. I think the Sanders people and the Clinton people who come out will be supportive of him. I don't think anyone's ever asked Donovan who he's supporting, but I'm guessing it's not Bernie Sanders.
For more on local elections, including the Wisconsin Supreme Court and Milwaukee County executive races, visit jsonline.com/politics. A full replay of Thursday's JS on Politics show is also available as a podcast. You can find that on both iTunes and Stitcher Radio. That ends today's show. Once again, I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for listening. And join us next week as I take you behind the headlines at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.